Well, I'm sure you won't be surprised when I tell you that we've been going through the Book of Samuel at my own church since last September, and we are well into the latter part of the book. It's been good for me this week to come back to the beginnings and just reflect upon the first chapter and look at that with you this evening. I was for a number of years, 7 years in fact, I was a missionary working on the streets of London, working with men and women who were living on the streets, and one of my tasks was to actually go out and walk the streets and find the men where they were, to sit and bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to them. And many a time, looking for men and women living on the streets who so often are inconspicuous, you find yourself in the most unusual of places. And being a Londoner born and bred, this is even more of a surprise. There were times when you found yourself sitting with someone and thinking, am I really in the middle of London? The surrounding kind of circumstances seem so bizarre, and the kind of busyness and the pride that the London is in its architecture seems so far away. Am I really there? I think it's a little bit like that when you come to begin to read the book of 1 Samuel. Where are we? Well, we're in the year probably about 1100 BC. And the writer begins his book in the most unlikely of all places, because he doesn't take us to the place to expect us to be taken to. We find ourselves in what can only be described in terms of the nation of Israel and the land in which they lived. We find ourselves in some backwater, some backwoods non-entity of a place. And we find ourselves introduced to a far from perfect family. All sorts of complicated domestic tensions in a family that's brought to us as we begin the book. And we're confronted immediately by a family who, particularly one member of the family, who's faced with that most devastating and desperate of situations: infertility. What a place to begin a book like this. Welcome to the world of 1 Samuel. Now, I want you to notice that the writer, as he begins a book, does give you and I a little clue that actually this isn't just some kind of 11th century BC kind of EastEnders idea. Notice how, as he begins the introduction and he begins to speak, you've got those words in verse 3. And he simply puts in that this man was going up to worship the Lord of Hosts. That is a title the Old Testament uses on a number of occasions for the God of Israel, the God of heaven. This is, in fact, the very first time that it's used. It's a title that actually the writer uses in many ways to give you a clue, to say, okay, now, as I begin this book and we start in this little kind of backwater, in this rather complicated family situation, I don't want you to lose sight of the fact that what actually is going on here is that the sovereign Lord of all power of heaven and earth is about to do something. This is no ordinary story I'm just beginning to tell you now, he says. This is an extraordinary story because it's a story about what the Lord of hosts is about to do, and in fact, he's doing anyway. Why are we here? Why does the writer begin here? Well, two things really. First, he begins here because he's telling us a story about the beginnings of a kingdom. The book is all about three men, really. It's about the kingmaker, Samuel. It's about the king who fouled, Saul. And it's about the ideal king, God's king, David. And here is the beginnings of an earthly kingdom in the nation of Israel, that transition from a people who had been brought out of Egypt and established in a kind of a almost a tribal type setting, now to be led by a king and organized as a monarchy, a kingdom. And yet, of course, the writer's point is that as he tells you this story, based in the facts of history, he is reminding you and I that there is a greater work going on here, because this earthly kingdom, the beginnings of this kingdom, is a preparation for a greater kingdom, as he's going to make clear as he goes on in the book. But there's a second reason why we're here. And the second reason we're here is this, because he's reminding you and I, in a very roundabout way, but he's going to bring it out to you. But what is the Bible's great and grand theme? Even here from this little backwater, even here from this place some 1,100 years before Jesus Christ was born, here is a writer reminding you and I that the grand theme of the Bible is this man, this person, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, whom we are so often exhorted to consider through this wonderful motive of prophet, priest, and king. And the great Moses has been the great prophet of God, who has established the priesthood of God and has called the people to remember that one day a greater prophet will come. And now we're thinking about a king. If Moses initiated the priesthood and spoke of a prophet, here's the beginnings of the king's kingdom. The beginnings of a kingdom. And what I want you to see this evening is just three simple things that actually should cause you and I to just wonder, to cause you and I to just wonder at the greatness of the God who begins a kingdom like this. First, God begins his kingdom in the most unlikely of situations. What a situation confronts us here. Here we are straight away, and we're introduced to Elkanah. And in spite of what you may think, Elkanah clearly is a man who's got a concern for God. He's a godly man. And yet straight away we find ourselves confronted with a problem, don't we? Because Elkanah doesn't have one wife. He has two. I was just reading this week, I had a couple of days off, and I was reading in the National Geographic an article on the particular fundamental branch of the Mormon Church, where they still practice this idea that a man can have more than one wife. Polygamy. The Bible never commends it. It never hides from us the fact that many of God's servants in the Old Testament practiced it, but we never find it commended, because it's not the creative ideal. It's utterly unconducive, of course, to stability, and it's inconsistent with the Christological pattern of what marriage is meant to be. But nonetheless, here we have God beginning to build his kingdom in this most unlikely of situations. What are we to understand about that? What are we to think about that? Well, I think we need to understand this first and foremost, that it's teaching and I that sometimes God's people, even the very best of God's people, allow their faith to be overshadowed by contemporary attitudes and values. Isn't it interesting that when the Apostle Paul writes some of his early letters, when he writes to the church at Ephesus, he reminds them that they need to step out now, because they're Christians, from the prevailing culture of this, that basically if you could steal something and take something, you could. It was your right to do so. Paul says, no, that's not how you're to live now as Christians. Or when he writes to Titus and talks about the church in Crete, he says, look, let me remind you, Titus, there's a cultural issue with these Cretan Christians that they're not going to escape from. It's his basis, they're lazy. Or perhaps more sadly, when he writes to the church at Corinth, and he reminds them that those who name the name of Jesus Christ can no longer live with that loose sense of sexuality and sexual morals that was prevalent all around them. And he says to the church, don't you realize there's an issue in your very midst that actually is an offense to the gospel? What's the issue in all those three cases? It's what we're finding here, if you like. Society constantly puts demands upon God's people. And we need to be filtering through those demands. But it reminds you of something more wonderful, doesn't it? It reminds you this is where God begins to build his kingdom. I think I'm right in saying that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Arthurs, it's Rumpelstiltskin, who used straw to weave gold. That's right, isn't it? He's not one of, no, Van Winkle fell asleep, didn't he? No, Rumpelstiltskin, yeah, he uses straw to actually weave gold, yes? You and I are being reminded here of how the sovereign Lord of all the earth begins his kingdom. God has his Midas touch, if you like. And it isn't to do with gold, it's to do with grace. And the Midas touch of the sovereign God who builds his kingdom and the God who weaves his kingdom is his ability to bring from the most peculiar and difficult and sometimes wrong circumstances by his rich grace the beginnings of a kingdom amongst his people. That should be tremendously encouraging to you and I. Tremendously encouraging. That there will be people who come into our fellowships, perhaps. People whose backgrounds are so radically different, perhaps, from our own. Whose lifestyles are shattered and shot through with all manner of social and difficult issues. And isn't it wonderful that we can say as Christian people, hey, we know a God who begins his kingdom in the most unlikely of situations. Isn't that wonderful? Second thing you notice in his opening passage is that God begins his kingdom in the most undesirable of circumstances. Sorry, similar words, but just trying to be a different idea here. It's Hannah's childlessness, isn't it? What pain is revealed to you and I in his opening words of this dear woman who was such a godly woman? Of all people, you would not have expected this woman surely to be in this sort of situation. Think about it. The stigma attached to it, to her, for her rather, as a woman in that particular society. The religious slur that perhaps was suggested by it. This woman can't be a good woman. If she can't have children, God is punishing her in some way. The confused thinking that must have accomplished it. Is it because God doesn't love Hannah? Isn't somebody like Hannah able to say, perhaps like we were trying to talk this morning, you know, in Isaiah 40, why is my way hidden from God? Why doesn't he see my circumstances? Why doesn't he see my pain and my despair that here I am, desiring nothing more than to raise a child up to God, and here I am not given that opportunity? One of the commentators says there's a fellowship of barrenness that is frequently used by God in dealing with his people. And you've got to ask yourself again, why is this? Why is it in this most undesirable circumstance that God begins to build his kingdom? Well, isn't the answer this? It's only when we are reduced to utter helplessness, when there is a total inability to change our circumstances, it's only when we realize that there is absolutely no way that we can open the door, as it were, and go through, that God actually begins to work. Isn't that true? Because there's a golden principle in God's modus operandi, isn't there? Isn't it this? My glory I will not give to another. It's going to be seen that this is something that I and I alone have done and am able to do. Nothing you could do about this. It's what I've done. And this, in this most undesirable circumstance, God begins to build his kingdom. Third thing, moving on, is in this situation that God begins to build his kingdom with the most unexpected of people. Who would have chosen Hannah? Who would have chosen her? And who would have thought, with Hannah, as we begin this book, and we were opened up to a woman who's in pain, who's poor, who's despised, and you've got to find yourself asking this question: what is God doing in Hannah's life? The answer, as we're going to see, he's actually shaping, he's moulding, he's forming her character to serve his kingdom's purposes. It would have been all too easy, would it have not, for Hannah to accuse God. Why have you done this to me, God? Or to wallow in self-pity. Look at this, it's not fair. Look at my compatriot here. Look, she doesn't care about you, God, it seems, and she's so unkind to me, and yet she's got children upon children, and I haven't got any. It would have been all too easy for her to be bitter, wouldn't it? But you see what God is doing. By manufacturing the circumstances that would isolate and leave her alone, he's thrown her back upon himself as her only refuge. Have you been in that situation, perhaps, believer, this evening? Have you been in that situation where it seems God has taken away every stool, every kind of, in the best sense of the word, every crutch that we hold on to? Why did he do that? Look at Hannah's situation here. Just think about it for a second. First of all, she's got an unsympathetic husband. Hey, if you're a husband here this evening, please learn with me from Elkanah. Don't do an Elkanah. Look at this wonderful example of incredible feminine insensitivity. Insensitivity towards the feminine sex. She's desperate. She wants a child. And what's his response? Look at his words to her in verse 8. Hannah, why are you crying? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? He wasn't, sadly, the sun, S-U-N, of Hannah's universe. And us Christian men who are husbands need sometimes to be a little bit sensitive to our wife's needs, don't we? And here's a case of somebody who really isn't. She's got that to contend with. Think about this. Here's a woman who, surrounded by the worship of God, is not satisfied with the formality of it. You notice what happens. They go up to Shiloh to worship, and they've been there and they've worshipped, but it's not enough for Hannah. She is so... She is so determined, she's so longing for God to bless us with it. She stays and she prays. It's not just a formality, she wants more. She wants to be real with God, and God to be real with her and to answer her prayer. And then she suffers the indignity, doesn't she, of Eli, the priest, watching her, watching her as she pours out her heart in prayer. I'm thinking, oh no, not another drunk in the precincts of the temple of God. What are you doing? He says, woman, stop being drunk. Oh no, I'm not. She says, I'm not. She's misunderstood. But perhaps worst of all, there was her, what do we call it, her fellow wife. What cruelty she endured. And yet, see what God is doing? Isn't it right to say, as the story goes on, that it is Peninnah's cruelty towards Hannah that fuels her prayers? It's the adverse circumstances and the goading that comes to her that drives her to her God. I don't know about you, but there are times in my own Christian life when I find myself in that sort of situation and I don't respond as Hannah did. So God is beginning to build a kingdom, but will you notice as he begins to build this kingdom through Hannah's life and circumstances, notice what is the tool that he uses. The tool that he uses, of course, is that inexhaustible weapon of prayer. Because Hannah's extremity drives her to pray. And you find her offering up this wonderful prayer to God in the bitterness of soul, we're told in verse 11. She vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction. Notice a couple of things about this prayer. Notice first and foremost, it's a prayer that reminds you and I of what I want to call the incongruity of grace. What's the incongruity of grace in prayer? It's simply this, isn't it? Well, let me put it to you in the words of a song, a modern Christian song, which I love very much. Who am I that the Lord of the whole earth should care to know my name, should care to feel my hurt? You see what grace does? Here is Hannah pleading before God. Lord, you're the Lord of hosts, the Lord of all the universe. But yet grace has taught me you care for me. And you encourage me to come with my pain. It's beautiful, isn't it? Notice too, in this prayer, there's a submissive sovereignty. If you will, Lord of hosts, if you will, grant this prayer to me. There's a freedom there in her prayer too, isn't there? There's a freedom and an openness before her God that is quite extraordinary. And there's a dedication too, because she makes this vow, doesn't she? If you will give me a child, O Lord, I will give him back to you. This isn't a rash vow, as some people often think. It's not a bargaining chip that she's throwing in. Actually, much rather this. It's a heartfelt expression of living faith. Lord, I'll give back to you what you give to me. It's quite a lesson there for those of us who are parents, isn't it? The longer I go on in not just in ministry, the longer I go on as a father, and I'm a father of four now, the more I realise that as Christian parents, our greatest calling is to learn to give our children back to God. And it's not easy, is it?
It's not easy. And yet here is a woman before she's even been given that most precious of gift who is set to say to the Lord, you give and I give it back to you. And notice there's a tangible contentment as she prays in this way. Verse 18, having had this situation with Eli, you find these words that Hannah went home, she ate, and she was no longer sad. What a tremendous expression of living faith in this woman. And in this simple prayer, you know, there is something that's inexcusable for you and I this evening as Christians. And isn't it this? We're in the beginning of 1 Samuel. We're looking at events in 1100 BC. We're not yet in that privileged time and place known as, can I put it this way? Hebrews 4. She's not yet in that place where she's heard those beautiful words that came from the writer of the Hebrews, that with great boldness we can enter the throne of grace and be heard because Jesus is there. And yet so often you and I, unlike Hannah, don't persevere. Perhaps that's why, I'll just throw this out, perhaps that's why God's kingdom isn't growing where we are, as it should do. Let me just kind of wind up by just this particular session with two lessons. Just two lessons from this whole the beginning of the book with Hannah and Eli and Peninnah and Elkanah. Two lessons. First is, let's never be those who categorize a person's spirituality by the circumstances they have to bear. I wonder if we were really honest with ourselves this evening. I wonder if we were a contemporary, what would we make of the circumstances that said there was a philandering Joseph lying in a prison cell because he had been not only unfaithful with his master, but devious? I wonder what would we have been there? I wonder if perhaps we'd have sat or watched Job as he sat on the rubbish tip, silent, totally dumbstruck by what had happened. I wonder if we would have thought, "Hi, pal, you got what you deserve." You see, Hannah's circumstances, you and I are taught, aren't we, were not caused by poor spirituality, nor were they the cause of poor spirituality. Neither, and listen to this, neither were her circumstances detrimental to spiritual progress. Why? Because we're being shown here that by God's grace, all circumstances are a nursery for spiritual growth. I have a friend who now ministers on the island of Jersey, and we've been out there a couple of times and preached out there. And one time I was out there, he was talking to me about, you know, one of Jersey's most famous exports, the Jersey potato. Some of you like Jersey raw potatoes? How nice they are. They're kind of cultivated, like so much stuff today, you know, in a modern way. But, do you know what the old-fashioned way was to cultivate them? In fact, they're going back to this. Do you know what they would do, the farmers?
at certain times of the year when the crops were planted, you would see tractor upon tractor on the beaches of Jersey. And on the beach of Jersey, the tractors with their trellis were picking up seaweed. And they would fill their tractors up with seaweed and would bring it back and would dump it on the crops. And you can imagine as the days and the weeks went by, as the seaweed just dried out and rotted, what sort of aroma came from that kind of environment, can't you? And you could see the mess as the whole kind of, the whole area just dried up of this seaweed. But I was, this friend of mine said, there's a farmer in the congregation who farms still in this way. Ah, but you should taste the results. You see the point? Seemingly all the decay that's on top, and yet what comes out. And so often God is able to do that in our circumstances. Our spirituality is not to, we're not to categorize a person's spirituality by their circumstances. God is able to bring good out of those things. But the second thing, just closing quickly, is that old adage, let's never judge a book by its cover. Let's never dismiss God by a superficial survey or a superficial view of his providences. Because as you begin this book and you see what's going on, you think, what on earth, why on earth rather is God doing this to Hannah? Where on earth is all this going to lead? And you and I then have this wonderful opportunity to read through the book and see where it goes. As Samuel's born and comes on the scene, and his ministry so profound and so vital to the history of this nation, this people of God. God is intimately involved in the lives of his people. That's what we're being taught. God is intricately concerned in planning his kingdom through the lives and times of his people. God is infinitely able from the chaos of time and history to establish his people. I don't want to engage in hyperbole, but let me say this, and we could talk about this afterwards. There is a thread that runs here from Hannah's infertility all the way to Jesus Christ's incarnation and his kingdom rule. That's the nature of the Lord of hosts and the building of his kingdom. And it's this great lesson that cries out to you and I as his people. Whatever we do in our day, in our particular time and circumstance, never to judge a book by its covers in terms of God's providence. Let me close just by quoting this modern song. When I'm weak, you make me strong. When I'm blind, you shine your light on me. I'll never get by living on my own ability. And here's the line. How refreshing to know you do not need me. How amazing to know that you want me. Isn't that wonderful? The God who builds his kingdom, who begins it so often in so unlikely circumstances. Let's pray together.